You are listening to Notes from Osgur.ca, written by Osgul Taken. This is Episode 2, Words That Eat Their Authors, spoken by Text to Podcast Magic. The work survives the maker. What do you do with the thing that impresses you when it shouldn't? Leon Trotsky arrived in New York in January 1917 as a committed anti-capitalist revolutionary, freshly expelled from Spain for being a nuisance. He stayed 2.5 months, living in the Bronx with electric lights and a gas range, amenities that apparently surprised him, and spent his days writing, lecturing, and reading in the public library. He had contempt for the Socialist Party leaders he met. He was waiting correctly for something large to happen back in Russia. He also wrote about New York with unmistakable recognition. He called it the fullest expression of the modern age, its geometry aggressive and new, its organizing principle, the dollar. These were not intended as compliments. But embedded in that critique was a genuine acknowledgement that the thing he opposed had produced something coherent and worth understanding on its own terms. This happens more than people tend to admit. You spend time among people whose assumptions differ sharply from yours, and the encounter leaves a residue. Not conversion, something smaller and more durable. The thing you opposed comes into focus. And so, slightly, do you. Trotsky read New York the way a serious opponent reads a rival, looking for what gave it force, what explained its hold. The account he produced was arguably sharper than what a sympathizer might have written. Art asks the same thing of us, just from a different angle. A film or a novel gets inside you before you've had time to make a decision about it. Then you learn something about the person who made it. A comedian who delivered comfort and laughter into living rooms across decades. A director whose formal precision shaped how a generation understood cinema. What the audience received was real. So was what came after. The Trotsky question and the art question share the same uncomfortable core. Whether something valuable can come from a source you'd otherwise reject, and what it says about you that it did. People rarely sit with both. Some virtue signal the rejection while still watching the films. Others quietly separate the two behind closed doors. Some burn the records, pull the statues, disassociate entirely. The extremes get the most attention. But the work and the person who made it are not the same thing, and never were. What the audience received was real. That doesn't have to change. The chairman declines the funding. You slide the contract back across the mahogany. The men in fleece vests look at it like it's a piece of fruit they've never seen. Their wealth, for the moment, is a historical relic. They don't know this yet. One of them starts to speak. The organizational chart he's scanning for was dismantled Tuesday by universal suffrage, so he isn't sure who to look at. The chief executive clears his throat. He earns a standard wage now, revocable at any time. He explains, as gently as he can, that extracting surplus value from the employees is no longer part of the business model. The word extracting seems to land hardest. The backers adjust their posture. One floats stock options as a motivator, which is the kind of suggestion that makes perfect sense if you believe the tools of labor belong to whoever shows up with a check. Nobody answers him. The silence is less hostile than instructive. Roles rotate on this team. A junior yesterday ran the stand-up. The person making the coffee wrote last quarter's projection. Nobody has been promoted because promotion implies a ladder, and the ladder was the first thing to go. What's left is work and rest, and the afternoon light hitting the window the way it does when nobody is trying to bill for it. The irony sits in the room without being named. 19th century theory and 21st century venture capital, staring at each other across a table designed to signal wealth. The investors are here to capture unpaid labor. The team has quietly decided compensation should match effort and eventually need. These are not compatible goals. The decision is less about overthrowing the system than about walking away from it. Declining the money means declining the pressure that comes with it. No relentless expansion, no extraction demanded on quarterly cycles. The office feels different already. Someone is eating a proper lunch. Someone else is leaving at 5. Innovation, we were told, requires rigid structure and a massive infusion of private wealth. You start to wonder what happens to all that creative energy when it stops chasing a spectacular financial exit. The real disruption, it turns out, was treating people like humans instead of human capital. The book that talks back. A toddler drags 2 fingers across a paperback and waits for it to do something. The page does not move. The toddler frowns, tries again, then looks up at the adult holding the book as if the adult is responsible for the failure. Nobody in the room treats this as funny anymore. It happens often enough now to be its own kind of moment. That swipe was a small category error in one direction, glass-shaped expectations applied to paper. The error running the other way is harder to name and getting harder to see. Adults thank the language model. They apologize for typos. They soften their tone when the answer comes back curt, the way someone might soften their tone with a tired colleague. The thing on the other end has no colleague-shaped concerns, but the manners arrive anyway. We tend to greet whatever talks back. The reflex is older than the technology by several thousand years, and probably older than language. Books, which also talk back in their way, never asked us to address them. That is partly why the metaphor AI is a book comforts a certain kind of thinker, and partly why it does not hold. Books do not apologize for being long. Search engines do not follow up. The thing that talks back occupies a slot we have not named, and unnamed slots have a way of borrowing labels from neighbors that do not quite fit. The cost of borrowing is small, until it is not. Maybe the next generation will inherit the cleaner instinct the way the tablet children inherited the swipe, born already knowing that this voice is a resource, and that voice is a person. The way most of us know, without being told, that a parrot is not asking a question. The line draws itself. Or maybe the swipe inversion has been waiting all along. Some of those toddlers grew up and kept reaching for glass when paper would have done. Some of them, by now, talk to the tool the way they talk to a friend, and to the friend the way they talk to the tool, and cannot easily say which conversation is which. The headline that ate the story, Moby Dick, retitled for the algorithm, becomes How One Man's Obsession with a Whale Destroyed His Crew and What I Learned. Pride and Prejudice goes out as, I misjudged a rich stranger and it changed everything. The Stranger publishes as, How I Stopped Caring and Started Living, which is what most readers were going to call it anyway. The grammar is familiar by now, a small set of templates, all variations on how IX, the Y that Z had everything, X is over and here's what comes next. None of it is new. The shapes were lifted from women's magazines and self-help paperbacks and grocery aisle advice columns decades before the recommendation feed showed up. And the feed taught us slowly that they worked better than whatever sober alternatives they replaced. Storytellers used to bury the hook somewhere around page 30. Cervantes opened with a man who reads too much. Melville with a sentence about names. Tolstoy with a generality about happy families that takes the rest of the book to undo. The medium subsidized patience, partly because hardcovers were expensive enough that buying one was already a commitment and there was no second screen to defect to. We have learned to title our own lives the same way, even when nobody is reading. A weekend trip drafts itself in the head as 3 days that changed how I see my job before the photos finish sinking. The templates always worked. They were just confined to the trashier shelves. And the trashier shelves used to be one aisle of the bookstore, rather than the entire one. The whole catalog retiled in the same vinyl. Newer readers may not notice the inversion. Titles will read as labels, not promises. The way older readers once read chapter headings without expecting them to summarize the chapter. The wandering opening of an old novel will read as a broken contract. And the book will quietly go back on the shelf. That was episode 2. New notes appear at osguradoye/notes. Next episode in 2 weeks. Until then.